Well, howdy, folks, and welcome back to another episode of MIP. And look who we have on with us today. We are joined with Raven Connolly. Raven is, I don't know how you describe yourself, a philosopher, feminist theorist. How do you label yourself and what you're doing?
Definitely don't call myself a feminist theorist, please. Exile that label. What would I call myself? I would call myself an extroverted, uninhibited person who likes to talk about things online.
Beautiful.
Digital socialite is what I've used before. That's like my moniker, so you could use that.
Nice. Very unpretentious sort of descriptions. I love it. I call myself a professional bullshitter, although I'm not a professional, I guess just a bullshitter.
That my Twitter handle or like my Twitter description is professionally in love. So you can also say
that. I like that.
Mine is crypto normie, I believe.
Nice.
Crypto normie, like professional bullshitter, and professionally in love.
Yeah. Crypto normie. I also go with meta normie.
Meta normie.
Go to, yeah.
That's good. I like that.
Just fire anyway. Meta onto anything, Ryan. That's
yeah. Right.
That's the trend. Yeah. And Raven, where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from Baltimore, Maryland right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Cool. I'm in DC, pretty close.
Oh, wow. Yeah. There we go. Cool. Yeah,
I've
East Coast.
Driven through Baltimore. I haven't ever stopped yet.
No.
Okay, that was...
It's an interesting place. I used to live here. My family's here. Like, that's why I'm here, is my grandmother is actually in hospice care right now. So I'm doing family support. And it's interesting to come back here as like a much more conscious adult person and be like, wow, this is an absurd place. Like downtown is absolutely decrepit. There's so many like abandoned buildings, beautiful abandoned brick, ornate buildings, gorgeous buildings. I would like love them to be in like West Coast cities that are tearing down all their buildings and replacing them with horrible architecture. And then there's these huge, beautiful estates in the suburbs that are just like gorgeous. It's just the most absurd place. But anyways, I'm in Baltimore.
Fascinating. And do you have plans to eventually come back to the Portland area?
Yeah, I mean, my stuff is there right now. My life is in a liminal stage.
Ah, okay.
That way, there's a lot of liminality. And yeah. Transition point, major transition year, and I'm kind of navigating the waters of my life. So
nice. Well, thanks for joining us in this state of liminality.
Of course. I guess
that's the trend these days. So to kind of set the stage for this conversation, you know, I was just telling Nate before you logged on that obviously, you know, gender war stuff, whatever that means, conflicts around, you know, feminist ideology, and obviously just full on, you know, dating, romance, all these things and all of the identity implications of these are all highly, you know, they're a big part of the culture wars, they're a big part of polarization. But it's not something I like hardly ever think about. I'm pretty clueless about these subjects. I don't have a very sophisticated integrative meta take on any of them. I just don't spend a lot of time thinking about them. But they're important issues to delve into and unpack. So I thought, well, what better person to do that than yourself? And one thing I've been thinking about a lot in particular is how people are of different ideological backgrounds are less and less coming together, dating or marrying or intermixing, right? And you know, the trends show that interracial marriage has of course really gone up in the last 40 years, 50 years. But in terms of ideological polarization and people of different political affiliations, we're moving further and further away from each other. And studies have shown, right, very intuitively that towns and communities with the most inter-ideological marriages and relationships are the ones that are the least polarizing and the most resilient to cultural and political conflict. So I've been thinking about, you know, let's make dating someone of a different ideological background sexy again, or sexy, right? And how do we kind of lean in and leverage that polarity? And is there a kind of, can there be a kind of almost an erotic dimension to that difference? And I know that that's certainly a theme that manifests in other contexts in regards to sexuality and relationships. But it seems like in our culture, that's not penetrated into thinking of ideological differences between people, right? So just that's kind of my overall frame. And Nate, you want to share some stories of your...
No, I'm not telling that story.
Okay, fine. Oh, fine.
You tell it.
It's
not a story.
Well, just being rejected on...
Oh, that one. Okay, yeah, I can tell that one. That one's PG.
Well,
okay.
Which one were you thinking about?
Matching with somebody on Tinder. Matching with someone on Tinder and, you know, you're talking for a little bit. You're talking for a few days, 3 or 4 days. And then she says, by the way, what are your political affiliations? And I say, because I am a Republican, not very far to the right. I'm fairly centrist on most things. But I say, I'm a Republican. I happen to think this and this. And she says, she had a big, long paragraph of a message saying, I'm sorry I have to do this. What was interesting to me was, I wish I could be otherwise than this, but I just don't think it's going to work out because of that difference. So, you know, there's anecdotal evidence in my Tinder escapades.
Yeah. Yes, this is an interesting issue. I think that it is true that there is some sort of erotic charge to the other, right, to someone who holds different political views. But I think part of what is problematic about our current context, the kind of fragmentation of community as such, or an overarching meta-narrative that holds people together in some sort of cohesive identity formation, is that aesthetic signifiers have become extremely important for identifying like emotional responses, right? So like if I see somebody who represents in terms of their appearance or the way that their avatar, the way that they appear online, that has some sort of aesthetic representation of who they affiliate with, and those are my political enemies, I have like a physical response. I actually don't feel like I have much of this anymore, but like, you know, this is like a common problem where there's very little object level understanding of how aesthetics and signifiers impact our emotional regulation. And people are identified with their roles and political ideology, which is like common. This is a Keegan stage. This is stage 3 in Keegan, right? Like, you identify with your roles. Your subjective self is how you are serving, how you're interacting with other people, how you see yourself is in relationship to others and their moral and ethical structures is your objective state, right? And so making that leap into a kind of self-authoring stage, which is the next stage in the Keegan model, actually takes that role structure of identity and makes it objective. Like, oh, now I can play with people who have different opinions than me and who look different than me because I'm not threatened personally. My identity is not threatened personally by people having different roles and different, essentially they become masks. They become ways of being legible to other people in society, and it doesn't become your intrinsic sense of identity. And, you know, the thing that's sad to me about the structures of our society is that, because this is very normal, it's just that we have fractured so much that it basically, and almost like we're kind of in a recursive loop where somehow politics has become this very reinforced idea of a personal identity, and it's been linked to things that people are continuously contending with across their entire lives, which is their body, their skin, their race, their ethnicity, and their sex, their gender. Those are things that we just always are relating to over the course of our lives. There's just no way that we can like overcome that, right? That's just, especially sex and gender, I think. I think for me, it seems like, you know, if we kind of think about like the Coleman Hughes, Camille Foster kind of like Black intellectuals that are out there who have seemed to make this jump into this like fourth order stage of consciousness, this Keegan 4 move, they don't seem to really identify very much with their skin color. It's not really like a problem for them. It's not a thing that they're trying to work out. It's just like, yeah, you know, I have this ethnic background. I have this cultural background. It connects me to these things, but it's not something that's profoundly orienting my identity. Whereas your sex and your gender is something that you're having to work out the kind of cultural differences between men and women your whole life, especially if you're like heterosexual and you're engaging in a relationship with someone of the opposite sex. There's a continuous investigation into the differences that you find yourself in terms of how you be in the world. And not only that, but there's such a loss of knowledge about the other sex in our culture. It's become extraordinarily superficial, the way in which we conceive of the other, that people have a lot of learning to do in relationship, especially like millennials, who I think are kind of in this weird stage where we've got the brunt of a loss of cultural grammar around these things. I think a lot of it due to politics and the internet. But the fact that that politics has really come for almost like completely the body, and you have to kind of, in order to play a political game, you're inherently engaging in some form of identity politics in the way that the country has kind of structured political engagement. It really, I think, stops this like natural kind of progression throughout people's lives, where they kind of transcend and include, understand that they have roles and that they're playing with them in reality, but they become less significant to them, you know?
Wow, yeah, that's really well said, because it gets to something I've been thinking about lately. There's a great book called Uncivil Agreement by a political scientist named Liliana Mason. And her diagnosis of the situation is that partisanship has become conflated with all of these other identity indicators. So instead of splicing them apart, like, oh, this is my race, this is my gender, this is my political beliefs, all of them are conflated into one, she calls them mega identity. So that this kind of centralization of identity leads to hyperfragility, right? Because if you threaten one identity, you threaten all of them. So it's like, oh, if I'm of a different political orientation than Nate, Nate's political beliefs threaten everything that I am about, right? Instead of just bracketing that to the side and say we can connect on 95% of other issues, right? Suddenly it's appear that, oh, this person's of a different political background than I am, then we're not going to agree on anything. And that affiliation alone indicates that you're against everything that I am, right? And so there's a kind of like a political creep or a hyper-politicization, right? The politicization of everything or seeping into everything kind of retards our intelligence in other areas of life, right? Because politics is such a divisive issue, we're worse at talking about politics than we are about other subjects, right? Even in our own communities that we're a part of, when it comes to politics or identity issues, the level of the conversation goes way down. Things become way more heated and unnuanced. We can talk about religion, spirituality, philosophy, all these non-politicized topics much more easily and at a higher level. But when politics starts to seep into everything else, that destroys our intelligence across the board. We get stuck at a very immature level of complexity, now thinking about every identity category or everything that politics touches, which is really destructive and unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. It's the structure in the interface of something like Tinder, for example, which I think any sociological analysis of this time that we're living in has to reckon with Tinder. And that, you know, there's a picture of you and then below it says, INTP, blah, 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 swipe in the direction of your political orientation. And it's all right there. And you have two options, left or right. You can't push it forward or pull it toward you and investigate any one of these things. It's left or right. And it reflects the conflation of everything in the face, the profile.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just a really, you know, horrible and beautiful intersection of like digital and like embodied life. Between like the kind of deep, you know, animal needs that we have. We're still primates, we're still oriented towards community bonding, a sense of belonging, we have sexual urges, we want to like come together with like people and form long-lasting bonds. Like all of this stuff is just very natural, very animal, and it's a perfect place to kind of capture that inherent kind of propensity of the human being and construct a game, a digital game, that basically inherently reduces people to avatars as a function, right? Like that's just how digital mediums work. You produce an avatar, that avatar reflects some sort of aspect of your personality. And for a lot of people, they identify very directly with avatar that they've produced online. And it becomes this kind of recursive loop where like they've produced this avatar, it appeals to a certain kind of attention or a certain kind of community, then that comes back onto them and they begin to reflect that avatar even more in this kind of cycle, particularly as it reinforces through positive or even negative affirmation, right? And I mean, this is consistent across the board with digital mediums. And it's something that I've been talking about more generally with people who are, you know, producing content. They establish an identity, you know, that's about a certain issue. For example, like for me, like my identity has been somewhat established around gender issues. So what if I came out one day and was just like, I am never talking about that ever again. I don't care. I'm over it, right? Like that would be kind of an affront to the identity that I've formed online, right? And so that is a, that's a move a lot of people make, is they don't allow for their digital identity to oppress them, you know, basically. But that's a kind of risky move that like a lot of people don't make. A lot of people, they just continue to play into projections of their fans, projections of their followers, and craft themselves into the image of whatever avatar that they have interfacing with their viewers online, right? And the thing of it is, like the digital space is just, it's a compression, right? And it's a, the medium itself is not representing the full context of the person. So it can naturally kind of highlight certain aspects of who they are and exaggerate them while putting into the shadows all of the other contextual information that might be relevant for actually understanding that person as a full person. Right, it's almost like being in a romantic relationship, like in the beginning when you're like kind of in love with someone and you're both presenting your best sides. You're like, oh, I'm this amazing person. I don't have any flaws. You know, you're like, you keep the bathroom door closed when you go to poop. You know, you're like, I don't poop. You know, it's like, you're just like presenting this image of yourself that you're like some sort of pristine person. And then eventually, because you're actually with a person, you know, you have to kind of begin to contend that that person doesn't actually this unflawed human being. It's they're in an imperceptible and risky person, right? Because their imperceptibility, because they're something more than what your like mind can fully understand. There's a risk to being involved with them as a full being. But on the internet, we don't ever have to have that moment of contention, of confrontation with the other in this full embodied way. And I think the Tinder, my God, it's like creates that digital environment in the present. You go out on a date with somebody, if you get to that point, right? And the smallest things, they're just like, oh, I'm not interested anymore. I'm either going to ghost you, or I'm going to send you a text message. And I'll be like, I'm not going to keep seeing this person because, you know, you said something weird or like, you know, we didn't relate or, you know, whatever kind of superficial reason that you have to just like toss someone away, you're still never contending with the other in that situation. You're never like forcing yourself to fracture your projections. Your projections onto the world, which are, oh, I expect a person to not say this thing. I expect a person to look a certain way. I expect a person to treat me a certain way. All of those things are can be forms of projection and also delusions, right? About your own sense of self-perception. And when you actually get involved with someone and they have self-respect and you have self-respect, you know, you bump heads with these projections naturally. Like that's, and to have lost that, for people to have been in a cycle where they're not being held in these relational dynamics for years, because they're just on this like treadmill of either being rejected or rejecting is like, I think profoundly problematic for our maturity as people. And the reason for it being in many cases like, oh, well, you're a straight white man, or like, you're not going to therapy, or like, you know, whatever. These really superficial signifiers of affiliation to basically fandoms. I mean, I think that, I don't know if you all know of Default Friend, but she's done incredible work talking about fan culture and the internet. And I think it's a really important structure to bring to any form of analysis, that's including the digital, which we're really just beginning to get words for in terms of describing this like landscape that we all find ourselves in. But fan culture is a fundamental structure of the internet. And so our political engagement is not an authentic form of politics in terms of having to kind of contend with the fact that there are different perspectives. You can argue them. You know, there's rhetoric to support many different perspectives because we live in a highly complex world and we all have incomplete kind of portraits of reality, and we have to take underlying assumptions. And, you know, the kind of legal debate aspects of politics are cast aside for the vast majority of people. And instead, it's become a fan culture. And fan culture has different logic to it than genuine debate for trying to reconcile political differences or political arguments, whatever that may be. So that's how I've been thinking about it more recently, like kind of locking that perspective and being like, oh, this is kind of like the same as people being like, oh, whatever, I don't know, the Broncos or like the Dolphins or whatever. I don't know anything about sports, but in sports, at least people are like, this isn't all of real life. They're like, no, it's not everything in the world. But with politics, and because it connects itself to the body, it feels like it's so important and like so critical for your like your whole sense of person, right? Like what you're saying, Ryan, I think is really true. Like by the more identities that you kind of collapse into a single structure, and any one of them can be threatened, it threatens the whole thing. Super fragile, and it digs you in more, and it makes you like represent your signals even stronger, so that the things that you don't want to see stay away from you, right? And it's like it's an arms race around fandom kind of conflict, and it's training our nervous systems to be reactive to the smallest of symbolism in our environment, like a bumper sticker, or you know, like just like the fact someone's wearing like a red hat and you like don't see the front of it, you're like, ooh, hat, you know, like this kind of thing, right? And it's very distorting of reality. And I think in particular, it's distorting of interpersonal relationships. That's where I feel like it's the most risky, right? Because yeah, whatever, you like don't like your neighbor or something because he's got like a sign on his lawn, like, okay, you know, that is bad, not a good sign for society. But like, when you're judging your friends that way, when you're judging your family that way, when you won't like enter into a relationship with somebody because they don't share the same opinions as you, there's such a huge opportunity cost in basically pulling out of relationships that challenge you on those levels. And a delaying of maturity, like severe delaying of maturity in terms of actually getting over this hump of identification with roles and into a stage where you're like, oh, my identity is actually rooted in something much deeper. And my roles and my opinions are not the only, that's not who I am. Like they're an aspect of how I'm legible to other people and they're significant and I'm working on developing them, but it's not the same kind of relationship at all, at least in my experience. That's how it's been for me.
I'm so glad that I'm happily married. I don't have to worry about any of this anymore. I mean, everything you said is so true, right? Like in the age of COVID, if I was trying to find love on Tinder, I would be single for the rest of my life. Like someone like me, right, and kind of my predisposition and my appearance, I would completely fail in this kind of hyper superficial signaling game. Right. And I think part of the problem, too, is that because we have these tech ecosystems that select for the most ostentatious display of symbolism and signaling, you perversely incentivize people to even more so kind of play up the signaling game and merge your identity with those superficial signifiers and kind of cut out the deeper levels of introspection or deeper levels of my own consciousness and development of the person that I can't convey in a Tinder, you know, I don't know, like five words on Tinder thing, or it's this kind of hashtag level thinking that's permeated everything now, right? And we can't, as you were saying, I think what's so important, right, is we can't look past the label. Like, we don't even give people a chance, right? Like that girl who rejected Nate based on his political affiliation, she doesn't know anything about
you. Very nicely.
She doesn't know anything about you. Like, it's like that alone is enough to like not even try to get to know you more, right? And that's just, and one other thing that's interesting, a statistic that I've come across recently, is that for people who are less politically engaged, they actually think more about policy substance and the practical material ramifications of that policy. Yes. Yeah. For people who are more politically engaged, they don't think about what that policy will do. They think about what would supporting that policy say about me or signal to my tribe members, right? So people who are more politically engaged actually don't think about economics. They don't think about tangible systemic ramifications of policy. They think about only about the signaling and identity aspect of supporting that policy or that candidate. Right. And again, that's just, it's really unfortunate, right? So the people who are the most active are the people who are thinking the least critically or the least substantively.
Right, because it's a conflation, which means it cuts both ways. So we're robbing ourselves of, number one, intimacy, and number two, of legitimate political discourse, both of which have to reckon with a certain kind of other. But the logics have gotten twisted so that we can't do politics or pure intimacy, but we feel kind of like we're doing both all the time, so that the two can't be separate things that resonate with each other, and then you form your identity, your character, in that conflict. And character is different than identity in that way. We're all forming identities in this weird, conflated system of horrible nightmare of socio-political intimacy, everything together. And that was Hannah Arendt's thesis too. I did my thesis on Hannah Arendt. She always pops into my mind during these podcasts, because it was, her whole thesis was that the socio-economic logic had overtaken politics, which was the realm of violence and conflict and reckoning with people, but still standing up straight and honoring each other by your being in the arena together. We can't do any of that anymore.
Yeah.
So it's a horrible state of affairs.
And I think, you know, Hannah Arendt, I mean, she was reflecting in a period of time that was really like dramatically affected by the shift in communication mediums that were happening. Mm-hmm. And I think we can't ignore those things. Like, that is just such a fundamental part about why this has happened, is like the speed and the kind of fidelity of representation on the digital medium. And the digital medium is interactive, which takes it even beyond the kind of broadcast medium of television, which was more receptive to an audience, right? You could do a kind of like vertical propaganda where you had some sort of image that, you know, the government or whatever the news wanted to portray, and people didn't have any other way of finding information. They didn't have any other way of like communicating in large groups about the shadow that was being like cast in the darkness until after the crisis was over. You know, the documents come out and, you know, there's like some sort of reveal from the media, and that was the media cycle for a long time. And now you just can't engage in that way anymore. We've lost the capacity to do large scale like propaganda campaigns without there being a group that like emerges, that like comes in as like the shadow of whatever, you know, is the government or whoever is trying to engage in that is trying to obfuscate in order to control the population. And so like propaganda and how it works within the new communication mediums, I think, is an incredibly important part of this. And the fact that horizontal propaganda is being used much more to manipulate people. And I think that's the whole thing about all of this, is like we're in a deeply psychological environment, deeply sociological and psychological environment, now that we're in an interactive medium that requires positive interaction, in the sense that you have to place something into it in order to play the game. You have to put content into the internet in order to really be engaging in the interactivity of what that medium is. And so it's like, what are you placing there is the thing that people end up seeing and engaging with. Everything else is being hidden. And because that's like the nature of the game and it's interactive, it's feeding off of pre-existing energy sources that we all have within ourselves. And that is like the emotional body. I mean, our emotions are like kind of interface with the pulling away and going towards, you know, that basic kind of dynamic of organic life. Do I go towards the thing or do I go away from the thing? That aspect of our lives that's fundamentally about navigating and decision-making, moving through environments, the fact that we're mobile, we're very old kind of mobility in our lineage, right? Like that is a force that is being manipulated through our interactions in this communication medium. And I just think that you can't really have a conversation about, you know, identity formation on now without including the digital, without including these like tiny little weird subcultures that arise on Tumblr or on 4chan, and then they spread. And like, I don't know if you guys, never mind, I won't go into it, but there was like a recent thing on Twitter that I think really showed this. Like there was a word cell, like show protein, you know, and like, you know, I've been in that world for so long, people making jokes about it for like months and months and months. And then finally it kind of went through this like arc of becoming more popular. And then like you saw how the media distorted it and used it to like, you, like paint a bunch of people as like white supremacists and like, you know, come up with a completely alternative history as to like where it came from. And like, you're like, oh my God, like that. And that was such an innocuous kind of meme that you see its travel into this like different scale of communication. And this has happened with so many different things, right? Like subcultures online kind of become the source of reporting for journalists working at the New York Times. They make something look way more important or significant or politically like valuable, worth your attention. And then essentially lying about the significance of the thing. And then because of memetic contagion, spreading it, you know? So like we're in some crazy like psychological house of mirrors, you know, that is continuously kind of reproducing itself and putting people into cages, you know, of projection and emotional manipulation. And I think one of the most important things that you could possibly do is to basically negate your identification with politics at all. Just be like, I don't care. I don't identify with that. That's not where the center of my being is anymore. And especially the stuff that's about identity formation that's related to your gender or your sex or your ethnicity or your family history, any of this stuff. This is the kind of thing that if you just embrace investigation in the world yourself, you will uncover your own story through participation with others. You don't have to have the answers about what it, like, I don't have to have the answers about what it means to be a woman. I'm 26 years old. I've never had a baby. I've never been married. I don't know anything about like the full life cycle of being a woman, right? Like, why would I think as a 26-year-old woman that I have a full, complete understanding of what that means? That makes no sense. It makes no sense. And for the fact that my identity has been like colonized by a political project that forces me to identify with a pre-existing simplified structure of what it means to be a woman in order to play a political game and engage with things that actually do materially impact me is, I think, a totally perverse frame that people, I think, are very like, you know, in our sphere or the metasphere or whatever, people are naturally exiting. They're just like, this is not, I can't identify with this because it's actually causing harm that is so much more great than whatever I'm losing by not being involved in the political conversation. And maybe I'll wind back up in politics, like I think probably I will, but I have to ground myself in my own being, in my own like navigational capacity before I could even possibly imagine reengaging.
And there's a lot of people who can absolutely relate to that attitude and that position, right? You know, the label, the exhausted majority. And that's actually kind of like our target audience, you know, and there's a lot of empirical data that shows that the exhausted majority actually do have the most eclectic and nuanced views on political issues. And that's why, because they feel politically homeless, you can't easily pin them down into a certain tribe where they have groupthink along with all of their tribe members. Right. So they are the most eclectic. They can embrace the perspectives from a wider array of, you know, from the larger range from the political spectrum. So yeah, I think there are a lot of movements now that try to give a home to the politically homeless or to give a voice to that neglected demographic. So that's something that we're trying to do here. I think for me, like, because politics and these identity issues are so divisive and so just the kind of the energetic toxicity of them, or like the polarizing energy of them, I just run straight towards it, right? I'm like, all right, like, let's do something.
Ryan's like, yeah, let's get in there.
Let's get into it. Let's get into all the controversial stuff. Let's get all into all of this really dark stuff, because I feel like that energy, right? All, and even in the pathologized sense of it being kind of super normal stimuli, it's still energy, I feel like, that can be transmuted if engaged with conscientiously and from a higher, you know, integrative meta perspective that valorizes nuance and complexity and multi-perspectivity.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, like, the other thing that I've been, like I've kind of noticed in a lot of these, like, spaces that people that I think are kind of congregating online around this, like, stage three to stage four, like, transition, a lot of them end up kind of going inward. Because I think what I've identified, particularly in looking at shame, which was something that I hadn't really even engaged with consciously until the STOA, right? And AJ Bond, you know, doing these shame sessions. And I was like, oh my God, shame. And I was like, I'm not going to go to those, but like, wow, what a concept. And it's only like in the last year that I've been like, holy shit, this has been ruling my life. And I didn't even, it was like a negative space. It was like an invisible structure that I had like no conscious awareness of. And now it's like a presence rather than like a hole. It's like, oh, I can identify this thing, the shame, and I can begin to work with it and like figure out how to not be susceptible to manipulation. Like, people are using this. People are using people's like emotional vulnerabilities in order to capture them and capture their attention and kind of keep them in a perpetual cycle of like low scale abuse, right? And so this is something that's happening all over the place, like in a horizontal manner. Like, a lot of communities are kind of based on some kind of, you know, abuse dynamic where there is subconscious kind of like guilt tripping or shaming that's like causes somebody to be attached to some sort of like figure to in order to feel validated, whatever. And if you're in a state where shame is ruling your life, or you've gone through some sort of like childhood trauma or anything like that, and you're trying to interface online, it's unfortunate to say this, but you're kind of compromised. Like, you really don't have the psychological structure to know that you're not going to be easily manipulated. And like, even the most sophisticated people end up manipulated online. Like, it's not really something that you can completely ward against just by doing like therapy or something like that. But you're at least kind of moving to a new scale of like skepticism and also just awareness, like the capacity to look at what's happening and be like, oh, these people are motivated by some unconscious shame, and that's part of why they're attached to this figure. They're projecting onto them this image. This person is then playing this game where they're identifying with their fans and the fans' image on them, and they're kind of stuck in this like weird codependent abusive dynamic. You can just see it in a much more conscious way and not look at the content. It's not about like what the person is saying. It's like, oh, they're in this kind of structural dynamic. There's a grammar to how these interactions are occurring, where the glue that's holding everybody together is this unprocessed shame around certain aspects of who they are. And that shame is a great emotion to, I mean, rage, any emotion is a great source of energy for capturing attention online. And it's palpable, you know, you can feel it when you navigate into little spaces. You're like, whoa, these people are like really vitriolic, like they're really full of this anger. And you're like, where is this coming from? And the question, like, who hurt you? You know, I think is like a really profound one to ask online, not in a, you know, people say it in kind of a flippant way, but I think in like a true and honest way, like who hurt you is a great question to ask when you see something like that online, because I think so many people are traumatized and there's so many reasons for that. And it's a huge negative space in terms of like literacy, basically self-literacy. It's like, if you don't know how you can be manipulated, then you may find yourself in some sort of manipulative dynamic without knowing it for years, potentially. So I think that that's another thing that's happening in these environments, and like the psychological turn of being like, oh, there's actually psychological dynamics that are kind of creating the grammar of this world, is like an important turn to make in order to kind of contextualize the things that are happening. Even though I don't think it's a final stage, I think that that's just like a kind of place to go through. And that's where I feel like I am. So maybe Ryan, you're a little further along than me.
No, I mean, it's it all makes complete sense. You know, I wanted to pivot a little bit and kind of put the this subject under the microscope, right? Which is kind of looking at the dynamics of otherization and how and the projections that go into forming our conception of the other. You know, whether that actually aligns with reality or not. And how that weaves into the conversation about dating, romance, sexuality, eroticism, and so forth, right? So just to give an example, I don't know if you know the book, The Dawn of Everything, that came out recently by David Graeber and David Wengrow. There was kind of, caused kind of a ruckus in, you know, some of our circles, and also, you know, got a lot of notoriety, but it kind of challenges. I mean, there's different ways of looking at how we, let's say, you know, in this context with indigenous peoples, right? Like some people have a very romanticized, kind of inaccurate, pedestalized perception, imagination of what indigenous cultures and societies were like. And there have been different attempts to kind of blow that up, right? My thing is that otherization in its worst form, right, obviously would be like the Nazis, right? Where it's like you otherize a certain group and it just becomes this totally unhinged, oppressive, jingoistic chauvinism where the other needs to be dehumanized and then exterminated, right? And then there are other attitudes to the other where it's like, hey, like, you know, there's a kind of like a overly rosy perception of the other, right? Where it's like, oh, this person, there's something mystical or magical or exotic about them, right? That's where the exotification comes in. I feel like that's kind of where that's how the romantic part or the sexual part, the erotic part comes in, right? It's through that exotification of the other. And I've always thought, like, you know, there's always going to be an other. Like, we're never going to be, you know, we're tribal people, and the concept of the other will always exist in human society. So if that's the case, and there's always a risk of having these really demonizing views of the other, is there a place for kind of like, as a first stage of breaking our stereotype, our caricatures, is there a place for this kind of romanticization of the other, right? As a starting point, or at least that engenders a more charitable attitude towards the other before nuancing and clarifying, you know, making more vivid your perception of the other, and kind of how does that relate specifically to political ideology or these aesthetic signifiers that we might be really allergic to or recoil physically, and also therefore not want to date the person or hook up with them or get to know them. It's like a threshold question almost, right? Like at a certain point, like, ooh, this person, like this is dark, and like that person is the other, I don't feel comfortable around them. But after a certain threshold, it's like, ooh, there is like kind of a dark mystique and a kind of exoticization and allure, right? Like, have you thought about, like, I'm not articulating this very clearly, but like, how does that work? I haven't thought about this very much.
I mean, I could talk about this from a personal perspective, which I think I pretty much only, I haven't studied this really like in a rigorous way, but I mean, in my own life, I think like I was raised like an environmental activist. I lived in Olympia, Washington, home of the Evergreen State College, is where I went to school. You know, like I've been in like very progressive environments my whole life. You know, I knew about gender neutrality when I was like 4. You know, like it's just been like the water that I swam in. And at some point when I was in college, you know, I think I was driving down the street and I saw like one of those big lifted pickup trucks, you know, and it's like, whatever, some like rural dudes were like driving to Safeway or something, and I was like, you know, affronted by it. And I had this thought, I was like, why is this is just an aesthetic problem? Like, I am just aesthetically repulsed by this. Where did this even come from? Why am I having this experience? Why am I recoiling in this way to like this truck? Right? Like, they're not bothering me, they're just driving. Like, what's the problem here? And I think when I made that leap, I also realized that I was attracted to it. was like attracted to the fact that it was off limits. Like, I think that that's actually part of why I even had that thought, was like something about the fact that that group of people had been kind of othered in my household, and were kind of off limits to me aesthetically. I didn't relate to it, made me feel fascinated by it. And so, I mean, and you know, my mother was a vegetarian, and like, you know, suddenly I was like, on an intellectual level, very interested in things like, you know, the embracing of like hunting culture as a way of doing environmental conservation, right? Like, that's how it worked out for me. It was on this like, you know, the environment, like people having this kind of like pristine idea of nature. We can't like tread on nature. It's almost like what you're talking about in terms of this romantic idea of like indigenous culture, people never hurting animals, or like it's staying in this like pristine way. And then instead I was like, well, what if hunting could help with, you know, environmental preservation? Like if we had preserves where people could go hunting. And suddenly like I started to kind of think about the perspective of and the lifestyles of people who had been off limits to me, in terms of the way that they were interfacing with the world, like the way in which they lived their lives, had been made kind of abject to me as I was being raised. And I found myself dating a guy who was more like that, you know, who was more masculine. He like, you know, went up to Alaska to do fishing, right? Like was much more aesthetically aligned with that type of lifestyle. So, and also kind of politically, probably more like where Nate stands politically, in terms of like center right or something like that. Center right-ish. Yeah. You know. And I don't know. So I think from my personal history, that actually has been something that I have like eroticized. That was kind of like an initial response to it. I was like fascinated, almost like there was like a kind of morbid curiosity aspect to it, but also
I love that word.
Yeah. Important thing, I think, to understand the natural inclination we have to curiosity, morbid curiosity, things that we're supposed to not look at, you know.
So
I noticed that pattern in my life. And I think that it was a kind of working out of projections and a limited view of reality that I was engaging in, and I was just doing it subconsciously. It wasn't something I was like, I think I need to, you know, break my projections on the other. It was just this like natural kind of inclination. I wonder now, though. I mean, that was what, like in 2014 or something, before like the kind of before the Trump era, right? I think now we're much more entrenched. And like, I had that space to kind of navigate things with much more of like my personal evolution. I was much less like imposed upon than I think a lot of people are today. But yeah, that was my personal anecdote about that.
That's awesome. I mean, that's fantastic. I mean, my entire thesis of this conversation is we need more people to be like Raven. Like more people, like if more people had that inclination, right? It's a kind of like cultural shadow work
that's
being worked out with the romantic other,
yeah.
Right? And that'll bring people
to the curiosity thing is right, because the more morbid is death, which is thanatos, you know, which is always there, but we repress that. And thanatos is the opposite of eros, but it's also interwoven in it. And it's the interplay between these two impulses that is the real meta eros. Ooh, the meta eros.
Yes.
But yeah, but the concern is now in 2022, it is now, where the tribes are so far apart. Could it ever be anything other than pure fetishization and exoticism? How you can't put two people in a room together in 2022 and just expect them to eventually like each other, I think. Maybe you couldn't in 2014. Do you have to indicate on a sliding scale where you fall? And you know, radical right wingers are meeting like me, wishy washy right wingers, and that's enough of a
That's enough of a difference.
Yeah, I mean, how does that work technically, Ryan, and for your app that you're developing over there?
Oh yeah, because the joke was like to try to create a dating app that was all about this. I call it Love Across the Aisle, right? It's like, you know, people can date for people who have that You want to share that other story, Nate, of what that girl told you at the bar?
That's the one I did. Anyway.
Oh, that's the one where Nate's mom can't hear what happened there. But that's the idea.
Like
though,
a because thing at the bottom.
I think you need a name. You need a better name for it. But like, I feel like you need, like, there's something like, I think what you should reveal about this is that there's energy there, right? So the thing that is like what you're talking about in Eros, the death drive, and all of this, like, this important kind of metaphor, at least metaphorical structure for trying to point out what's going on here, which is like the energetics of like psychological, like neural structure, really. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Qualia Research Institute, but they're, you know, studying psychedelics and, you know, neuroanatomy, and how do you fundamentally restructure the brain, right? And a lot of it has to do with energy, right? So the in order to get into like an annealing process, which is basically like in metallurgy, a recrystallization of like neurological structure, you first need to get into these high energy states where the brain essentially can't there's so much free energy, but it can't just put them into the pre-existing sinks that it's created in order to kind of maintain essentially a kind of like low energy state in a person so that they can just kind of survive, right? And navigate their environment. So the more that energy like is being used to keep people apart, there's a form of resistance or repulsion, it's kind of wedging people, the more energy is needed to smack those things together. And the more of an eruption you're gonna get when you do that, right? There's gonna be more of this like kind of intensity to it, which I think is maybe where like fetishization comes in, or like where you find this in kind of like pornography, or you find it in like, people that are more explicitly engaging in like sexual energy and these like, you know, fetishes or BDSM, although I don't know how much they go into like politics stuff. It's very interesting to me where what is taboo and what isn't taboo. Like, I don't even know. It'd be interesting to ask someone in the BDSM community if there was ever like, you know, a kind of experience with consensual where like someone dresses up like a Nazi or something in order to do some sort of like
it is a thing.
Like that type of thing, there's so many people are doing it because there's so much energy in breaking that taboo, but because it's so off limits, it needs a container in order to engage in safely, right? Like probably out of that context, somebody wouldn't want to date a person that is like openly being a Nazi, right? Like you're like, no, I would obviously wouldn't want to do that, but I might be down for some kind of like performative othering where I can engage with my fantasy about this other and their power and their like elusiveness and my morbid curiosity about what it would be like to interact with them. Oh, I can do that in this container that sets this kind of like ritual structure for me to investigate this form of curiosity that I have, right? So, you know, in terms of like what's necessary to bring people together who have been wedged apart, I think it takes so much energy. Like it takes these really peak experiences for the brain to get superheated, to go through a liquefaction, right? Where the distinctions and the categories and the structures that people have already reinforced in their mind are literally liquefied. And then the cooling process, the annealing process, is the restructuring of the brain after some sort of extreme experience like that. And I mean, and those things can basically return if you don't do anything intentional in that integration process, but there is the potential for radical restructuring of the brain when you begin to play with the energetics of being. I mean, like it's fundamentally an issue of energy, I think. Emotional energy, also experiences. Like there's some sort of energy that, you know, you're talking about, Ryan, of going into these heated environments online and like, yeah, it's like, ooh, you know, it's like can kind of get yourself into this like high energy state where there's a curiosity, there's like a restructuring of your brain. Gives you more perspective. Like there is a way to make that type of thing engaging and fun for people and not like emotionally exhausting, like part of their energy sink, right? Like there's ways in which it becomes part of your like pre-existing patterns and notions that kind of keep you from going through this annealing process, which is necessary for health across someone's life. That's like, would be like, this is bad. And then this is good. It's like, oh, I'm finding energy in my environment that gets me into these like intense states that allow for this restructuring to occur, this liquefaction to occur. And then I have a new perspective when I come out of it. So I don't know. I don't know how to deal with the extremes. I think that that's where you have to start looking at the stories of people who've done peace and reconciliation work. You have to look at, people who've been working with like white supremacists and like these actually extremist groups in order to kind of fully understand what's necessary to shift somebody's identity and have them incorporate the perspective of the other. And I think it's very noble work, but there is, like you said, Ryan, all of these people in the middle who aren't so extreme, you know? And for them, I think there's tremendous potential for actually creating some sort of meta culture that can kind of make people exist pluralistically, but also give them a way of being legible to each other in a greater social context, which I think is what's missing now. Like even though there's this excluded middle or like the shadow of nuanced kind of individuals, there's not a lot of legibility socially around that, which is what disempowers those people politically. They're not seen.
Exactly. Yeah. This is such a fantastic conversation. And just such an incredibly just weird, bizarre, but I think so potent because, you know, as you said, right, like you need a high energy state to disrupt pre-established and trained patterns that people get locked into or lodge into and just kind of repeat in a kind of trauma cycle. And you need the energy to break out of that or to burst out of that. And it's like, well, where does that energy come from, right? There's a lot of negative emotions that make us not want to talk to each other. But the positive emotion that contains that much energy is located in the erotic, fetishized, romanticized projections, right? And I think that, yeah, if there is a way to kind of tap into that or make that a thing, as you said, where it could be like safe or, you know, it could be more easily justified to engage like that, where that kind of cultural shadow work can be done and people can start, you know, people of different sides can start getting together and having intimate relationships and getting to know each other on a deeper level and start families together, right? We'll have a much more resilient, less polarized society. Actually, it's interesting because part of my professional work is working with extremist groups in Portland and doing, you know, like ideological de-radicalization and violence de-escalation work. So I work with different foundations and nonprofits and organizations that try to do this, right? And it's obviously a very complicated issue. It needs to be tackled holistically and systemically. But the real key to it, right, is building relationships with people, building intimate relationships with people, building friendships with people, not judging them, not attacking them, but getting to know them as a human being and know that that's going to take months, if not years. But that is part of the kind of de-radicalization process, right? So this is all things that I'm involved with and I'm kind of keeping up with the research on. But of course, the thing is, well, there's not enough people. Like, I can't befriend every neo-Nazi and Antifa person in the greater Portland metro. I could try, right? And do that undercover or whatever. But I think that because the problem, of course, is the motivation issue. It's like, well, why should I talk to some crazy racist, you know, like someone who's so different than me? It's like, we have nothing in common. I just hate them, get annoyed with them, right? And that's, again, where the erotic part comes in. I now have an incentive to engage with someone. And really, you know, engage with that difference because it's pleasurable, because it's enjoyable, and it provides the energy for me to break out of negative patterns. So this is something that I don't see anyone talking about in the depolarization world. I think we need a dating app to really make it happen. Yeah.
Oh God, you got to get the framing right. I feel like that's the thing. You have to get the framing right. I don't know that people at a glance would be interested in something that is like branded as being across the aisle, but like there's other ways of framing that similar thing without making it so explicit. You have to like play the manipulation game in order to like hook people.
I do think there's something to be said though, just for you make the app, and in so doing, you are asserting that there is this desire for it, and people look at the app and they say, "Oh, wait, I guess I do want that," you know, because I think people actually do want tension and high energy situations and ritualistic sorts of encounters where you're going into it with the "I am left wing and they are right wing, and this is we're going to play a game here. It's like a game, but we repress that."
I'm gonna make a terrible joke that I might delete. It gives a whole new meaning to the phrase if we build it, they will come.
Don't delete it. No, I think you're right. But that is I think if you build it, there is actually a market for something like this. But I do think it's important there are certain sorts of structures in the app. It can't be like Tinder. It can't just be left, right forever. It has to be something like coffee, meat, bagel, I think, where you only have like a day to message them, or they show up in your thing every day and you have to message them within that day or something like that, just so that it doesn't end up being, because the tendency, the gravitational pull will be to fall back into something that's Tinder-like, you know?
Yeah, I think part of the problem here is that like repulsion is such a powerful emotion. Mm-hmm. And I think like it takes a kind of either unique type of person or somebody who's kind of gone through some processing of their own to see repulsion as not a simple get away from response, right? I mean, I'm kind of like this. I think maybe this is why I've gone down this path where I'm like, if I'm in pain or uncomfortable by something, that does not mean that I leave or get away from the thing, my discomfort or pain. I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Like, I'm experiencing a great deal of discomfort right now. I wonder why. I wonder what that's about. Like, you know, is this rational? Like, or is this like some sort of weird, you know, delusion that I've been living in? Like, there is this active understanding inside of me that like pain is not something that you merely want to get away from. And I think for many people, it's pretty straightforward. Repulsion is get away, attraction is go towards. And this is also an issue in dating in general, which is like naturally, you're going to go through attraction and repulsion cycles with your partner, regardless of how stable you are in your relationship. You are going to have some periods where you're like, ooh, you're hot, like you're interesting, like you're cool, like I'm into you. And other periods where you're like, God, like, can you get away from me? Like, you are not attractive, you're annoying the shit out of me. Like, And I think there seems to be a loss of literacy around overcoming the kind of natural towards and away dynamics that we experience with the most intimate people that we have in our lives, right? Like, instead, people are like, oh, I'm feeling bad about this person, I should break up with them. Like, there's no, like once again, it's a subjective identification with emotional states that is... doesn't kind of give you enough of a sense of the complexity or like even the long-term kind of arcs of these dynamics, right? Like, so in a way, I think a lot of it has to do with the lack of, like the grammar of our culture is kind of like going towards zero, right? Like we don't have interpersonal literacy to handle what you're talking about for a lot of people, right? They need help. You need to at least be primed. You know, you have to be like, you may feel a great deal of repulsion about the person that you're about to go on a date with. You may hate them, but this is not a sign that you're on the wrong track. This is actually good. Be like, what the hell are you talking about? You know?
That's a good point. Yeah, there needs to be more ways for people to develop the intelligence around all of this extremely flammable stuff, you know?
We keep coming back to the like talking about axes. It's intelligence with this depth axis, because we have the vertical thing, we live with it every day. We have the horizontal thing whenever we go on social media, but it's the depth axis that's missing. And even right here, I'm looking at my own face talking right now. Like, it's weird. This is a weird state of affairs to be in, that I see three flat faces on my flat computer screen. This is not good. So that's why I say it has to get to the date fairly quickly. It can't stay on the app. It has to get to, you're looking at a person across the table from you.
And hopefully, but if it's mostly, if people's, you know, incentives are mostly sponsored by purely erotic fetishization, you can bypass rational overthinking and analysis paralysis because you just get to the date.
Yeah.
Because it's pure sexual energy based on that polarity, right? I don't know. Right. I'll have to think more about it. Pivoting a little bit in the last 20 minutes, Nate, I know you wanted to discuss that pinned tweet of Ravens.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your pinned tweet here because I
think
it's good
on the same nice note
to ask people about what they deem worthy of pinning, and also because I'm interested. And it says, okay, I've been mulling on this idea that our relationships are bigger than us. This makes sense in a literal way. Our social ties can open up untold possibilities, but I also mean this in a fuzzy spiritual sense. Our relationships are part of something bigger, something closer to God. And you go on and on. And at the end, you say the hippies were right. And what they were right about is love. Love as the center of what should be our political life. And I was just wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it's so that thread was inspired by me just like experiencing deep feelings of unconditional love in my life. And feeling like there was a meaning to those relationships that was opening me in a way that made me feel a greater capacity in general for love and compassion. And that's what I mean about getting closer to God. And I use the concept of God very frequently. I mean, it's definitely one that is not abject to me. God is not abject. God is like a very, I think, extremely critical concept. Like the fact that we've made it abject, I think, is deeply problematic for our culture. And in terms of trying to participate in a knowledge of the whole, you know, and in an expansion of oneself and one's awareness, and to be able to hold the contradictions of existence, to be able to hold your own resistance to things, and to, in the face of that, engage with the imperceptibility of another human being, with the freedom of another human being, and still carry love for them. I think that this is where you start to go through a spiritual practice that can allow you to expand, to hold the world, you know? And to me, this is where it does get into politics. Like the fact of it is, if we're trying to face incomprehensible problems, such as like global climate change or like nuclear armament, or like the fact that there's just like ubiquitous guns everywhere, like any of these kinds of highly distributed problems with kind of unexpected effects in the world, there's a lot of anxiety that can arise from trying to contend with those things from a place of resistance and a place of like being closed. And I mean, I think that this is very like a tantric approach, right? Like to be able to hold both like the ugliness and the pain and the disgustingness and like, you know, the horror of death and like of disease and all of these things, and like the beauty and wholeness and holiness of reality as all of God, as all of what we are participating with in the world, and love through all of those things. To me, that is like a spiritual engagement, a spiritual practice. You know, like for me right now, I'm here with like my grandmother. I'm like watching her body deteriorate. I'm watching her kind of be reduced to bodily function as she's like just sleeping all the time, and she's up to these machines and hospice care. And the fact that like I'm actually here participating with her, seeing her body go through this process, I'm having to learn how to love her, even though she's reminding me of my own fear of death, of aging, of like deterioration of disease, right? And like being able to kind of expand my love and care, you know, which is easy if she's my grandma, so like I already have love and care for her, but to be able to kind of face her in this state and still find affection and still find deep love and a sense of connection rather than like this desire to kind of pull away, I think is the kind of the ground for like embodied practice of accepting the nature of a greater reality that we're all sharing, and that we all better be prepared for. I mean, like, the social collapse creates a lot of ugliness. It creates a lot of trash and disorder and tragedy. And to be able to hold tragedy, things that are just like completely abject, you're just like, why did it happen this way? Why did this horrible thing have to happen? Right. And you want to respond either with denial or bargaining or any of these like ways of pushing away this reality. To be able to hold it, I think, is a necessary toolkit, you know, part of the toolkit for like the liminal warrior or whatever you want to say, like whoever, people who can actually handle what we're entering into need to have this foundation, I think. And once again, it comes down to the relationships that you're in. Because if your relationships are, if you're challenging yourself to hold the parts of other people that are ugly to you and ugly to them and make you scared shitless, then you're having to expand yourself from the inside out. And I think that's the core of the spiritual practice to me.
Awesome. Yeah, everything I was going to ask you about it, you actually addressed in your answer, because I think the hippies were right in thinking that it is Eros that needs to be the center of our politics. But where they went wrong, perhaps, what made them fizzle out when they did, was that they conceived as Eros as something purely universal. That I love everything, like Zach Stein's cosmoerotic humanism. But we had him on here, and he either corrected himself or clarified himself on that, and said, yes, no, actually, it has to do with the particular. It's a particular person, and through that particular, you get to the universal. So as you say with your grandmother, you're there with her physically in person, and you feel this love toward her only. You're only feeling it toward her, that it's a singularity. But in that's, you can expand, and you can, it's not even that you're using the same logic, it's just that it enriches everything else. It's the motor. So yeah.
Totally. Great. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think I don't know, one of my issues with like liberalism is like this kind of abstract concern with like population level, you know, identification, right? That just like naturally leads to there being some sort of like tokenized representative of this like overarching, like abstract kind of collective group that reduces any given individual, you know, to that kind of appearance of a representative of some sort of like statistical reality. But I also think it creates a kind of gap in our concern, where like your immediate relationships are not your source of care, you know, and maybe you reject your parents, or you like don't have, you know, you're anxious, socially anxious, and you can't actually handle social complexity, but you're super concerned about like, you know, this far distant population of people that you've never met and you don't know. And I think that that's like, the fact that in our country there has been a political bifurcation around like right being like personal responsibility and personal relationships, localism, immediacy, and abstract concern for population has been like universalism has been pushed onto the left, I think is like so bad. It's so bad. It's so totally both. You know, it's definitely, and I think it's an emergent property. It is something that arises from interpersonal dynamics. It's made something that I think is crucial for any of the loftier goals that people on the left seem to have. They have to begin to participate honestly and openly in their interpersonal relationships. It's the only way to have the character to handle these larger population level dynamics. That's the only, like, to me, I'm like, this seems obviously the only way to do that, because it's people fundamentally that we're concerned about and that we have to work with. And if you don't have a deep rootedness and respect for the human experience, how are you going to even begin to engage authentically with these larger level problems? I don't see how it works without becoming a signaling game, which I think is what we've been talking about.
Yeah, Absolutely. And, you know, a big part of that too is a scale issue, right? It's like what's able to scale in our hyper-globalized, interconnected society, everything mediated through technology and social media. So we just end up creating selection mechanisms that upregulate superficial and hyper-polarizing stimuli and signals. And so it's like we resort to abstract categories that don't match, that don't align well with the scale at which they should be understood at, right? And so, but you know, going back to, it's interesting because there's kind of like a pre-modern, post-modern pincer attack on classical liberalism that I find to be very interesting, because one of the criticisms of classical liberalism, and I think this is a really interesting critique when historians think about like, why did the, how did the Nazis and the conservative revolution in Germany, like what the hell happened to classical liberal values of, you know, universal humanism and democracy and you know, all these, you know, liberal values that are the foundation of modern society, like what happened? How did they get supplanted and steamrolled by this totally mythic authoritarian fascist regime? And one of the critiques I find very interesting is that it's like in this kind of liberal, you know, toleration of differences, right? And like valuing, like John Stuart Mill talks about people experimenting with their own lifestyle choices and having freedom. Like there isn't really like an Eros component, right? So liberalism and liberal values gets outcompeted in the age of supernormal stimuli, in the age of game theoretic Nash equilibrium pressures that select for the most outrage, right? Classical liberal values, again, in this age, are going to get steamrolled, and we're going to see extremism really arise as a threat and a competitive force, right? So that's kind of when people say, well, how is meta-ideological politics, right? How is what you're doing different from like enlightened centrism? Like, I hate the word, like we call it like virgin versus Chad centrism, right? So virgin centrism is a single point along the political spectrum that excludes all of the other ones. But Chad centrism is like, you know, per our logo, right? Like the Zen, the circle, the Enso, it encompasses the entire spectrum, right? We encompass the extremes and are beyond them, right? And ideology, it's such a loaded word, right? And attributed to so many of the horrors of history of these, you know, these vicious totalitarian ideological regimes that capture people's imagination and lead to all kind of dystopian scenarios. It's like, well, if that's true, then meta-ideological politics is like homeopathy, right? It's very tantric, as you said, right? It's taking all of the potential dangers and all of these virulent energies and rechanneling them to a higher level, right? And so that's kind of, I think, it contains the Eros, it contains that erotic dimension from enfolding all of these aspects and bringing them together. And so, yeah, I just wanted to kind of throw that out there too, right? It's like, the classical liberal paradigm, it can seem very weak, like just weak sauce and lame and boring and banal and insipid. And so like bringing that juice back and that passion back to us is something we've talked a lot about, me and Nate, and it's a really important part of what we're doing. So yeah, I think this conversation kind of perfectly encapsulated that part of it that we haven't touched on as explicitly in previous episodes. So yeah, Raven, this has been so fantastic. Thank you for making the time to come on and talk to us. Anything more you wanted to say or end with in a particular note?
It could be its own podcast, and I'm going to make it short and sweet. But I think that this, where we've come to in this conversation, is exactly why, like, this is key insight. It's about channeling energy. All about channeling energy. And this is where it starts to become kind of mythic, or you need to reach for philosophy or spiritual language in order to talk about how to actually, or religious language, in order to talk about how to live cohesively in a society, because we have these energy potentials, the energy potential of anger, of morbid curiosity, of like predation, like wanting to be a predator is an aspect of human nature, right? Wanting to be a prey animal, like all of these things are energetic potentials that exist within who we are, not only as individuals but in groups. And I think like a healthy society finds ways of creating symbols that move these energies in a sophisticated manner, where people can actually develop the ability to identify these flows and play with them in a way that rises, like brings everyone up into a state of like higher collective consciousness, a higher state of development in terms of how they sit inside of themselves and are interacting and interfacing with the world. And I think art becomes an important kind of almost utilitarian, right? Like if you want to say, it's like there's a practical aspect to art in the sense of how it's channeling these energetic potentials that exist within our worlds. And the fact that we have in American culture, a lack of art that's really getting at the taboos. Like I would love to see a film about a man and a woman who have different political values actually working it out, actually being invested in each other, but actually also hating each other because of political values, and then finding a way to resolve that throughout the course of character development in the film. But we're not really seeing these things. And cultural critique is also terrible. I think this is another thing that we need a revival of really good critique, because there's lots of people in the New York Times who are you know, looking at films and things that I think are trying to point at some of these things, misinterpreting them completely. So like that's the type of thing that I think we need to be turning to in this liminal space. It's all very abstract and intellectual, and it's all very fun for people who like ideas, but ultimately it's art, you know, that can arrest a person, that can get them into these high energy states, that allows them to kind of alleviate the pre-existing structures and the way that they channel energy inside of themselves, and allow them to get into this annealing phase and process, you know, through the kind of stories that are being told, right? So that's where I think my thoughts are going in these days, is like, okay, how do we make arresting art that really puts the contradictions into the same frame and forces people to contend with the psychological dynamics that we're totally immersed in today?
Oh, that's so beautiful. And again, to plug the logo that Nate's brother made, I mean, part of this was that like the Zen, it's the contrast of like, you can see the American flag outline, right?
Yeah.
In the Zen circle of emptiness, right? So it's like the ultimate union of form and emptiness, where it's like, there's a kind of patriotism, right? There's a kind of almost a conservative ethos that we're trying to reclaim, but held in this consciousness of emptiness and transparency, a la the Zen and so. So that's kind of our theme.
I love artistically,
that. Aesthetically.
Awesome. Yeah, it was such a pleasure to be on with you guys. It went by like that. I'm like,
I know, unbelievable.
I'm sorry, I have to go. I had a hard cutoff, but
no, it's perfectly fine. It's probably good for the audience.
Yeah, maybe, so. Perhaps.
All right. Thank you, Raven. Great to see you. Great to catch up.
Of course.